So this is August 17th, oral history interview with Joe Gonzalez, retired fish and game warden. So would you say your name and spell it for transcription?
Okay, my name is Joe Gonzalez, last name G-O-N-Z-A-L-E-S, first name J-O-E.
Okay.
And I am a retired fish and game warden, been retired since 2004. And I retired at the rank of assistant chief in the enforcement division.
Okay. So let's start with talking about where you were born, what year.
Okay. Well, I was born in Southern California in Oxnard in 1952.
Okay.
So I'll be turning 60 this year. So.
Happy birthday.
And grew up on the coast. Oxnard is a coastal city in Ventura County, mm-hmm. and I grew up around the ocean, so I was very familiar with the ocean, the coastal line of California. I guess my background with my family, I'm the second oldest of seven children. Mm-hmm. I was the first to, we all graduated from high school. I was the first in my family to ever graduate from college. So I think for me that was an accomplishment.
Yeah.
But prior to that, I grew up, like I said, in Southern California, around the ocean. And I guess you could say that our family wasn't very well off. So my dad worked as long as I can remember, never missed a day of work in his life. My mom, they both worked in packing houses. And about the first 6 years of my as I can remember my life, we basically lived what people refer to as the other side of the railroad tracks. So, and lived in a neighborhood where it's primarily Hispanic or Mexican American and a few blacks. But it wasn't until sixth grade or fifth or sixth grade that I actually went with the Anglo kids or white kids. So, and I mean, it wasn't a shock to me, but it was things were different. So, but I think that was for the better, and basically, you know, I think it gave me it rounded out my childhood and upbringing and things like that. So, and I was involved in sports, baseball, all the way through high school, and I graduated in 1970 from Wainimi High School in Oxnard.
Wainimi.
That's H-U-E-N-E-M-E.
Thank you.
No, and basically. Although it was Wainimi High School, it was still in the city of Oxnard, and Wainimi is known for, actually, Port Wainimi, which there's a military Navy base for Navy Seabees, the Construction Battalion Center.
Okay.
So that's kind of what it's noted for. Okay. But I graduated in 1970. No way was I ready to go to college. You know, college was kind of the furthest thing from my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it wasn't for sports, I might not have... made it in school, so it kind of kept me on the straight and narrow. So after I graduated in 1970, I was going to enlist in the Marines. This was during the Vietnam War when it started to escalate.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a low draft number, so either I enlisted or I was going to get drafted anyway.
Right.
So I enlisted at the end of 1970 in November and enlisted in the Air Force. Spent 4 years in the Air Force. I think those 4 years, for me, I think I matured. I think by the end of the 4 years, I basically had it in my mind, you know what, although this was a good experience for me, I need to get back to school.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a lot of people in the Air Force that were there for the ride, you know, and really, as far as I could see, weren't getting anything out of it but a paycheck, you know. And I saw a lot of things during those 4 years in the Air Force. It was during the Vietnam War. I would, every night on the flight line, I would see aircraft coming in, bringing in casualties from Vietnam.
Where were you stationed at?
Travis Air Force Base. Yeah. And I was also there during the end of the Vietnam War when our POWs came home.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel you probably, that's just history for you.
Sure, yeah. My dad was also in the Army, so
yeah.
But he doesn't...
Yeah,
so, yeah.
But, you know, I think it was a maturing experience for me. I was able to get out of, you know, I had an honorable discharge from the Air Force. We moved back down south. My wife and I got married after boot camp in 71. So my wife and I had our first child just before I got discharged from the Air Force in 73.
Where was your boot camp at?
San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, okay.
Lackland Air Force Base. Okay. So, but I think everything that I did that was away from home helped me mature as a person and made me, I guess you would say, a different perspective on the way things were. Mm-hmm. So,
during your youth, were you involved in wildlife or outdoors? Did you do a lot of within your family, like outdoor activities? Was that something that you just knew?
Well, I remember growing up that every summer that my parents would take us camping, and I remember going to Yosemite and going to the coast, Pismo Beach, and things like that. So, I guess my experience I guess you can call it introduction to wildlife or things like that. But, you know, growing up, you don't see it as that. It's just an experience.
Right.
And, I remember seeing park rangers or whatever they were back then, and that would be a neat job. But for some reason, even during my high school days, something in me, you know, maybe law enforcement, I'd always wanted to be a probation officer. And that being in the law enforcement arena. So I guess that would be my first introduction, you know, growing up and experiencing, you know, the park system and things like that, and then visiting different parks throughout Northern California and things like that. But most of our vacations growing up had to do with camping. I don't ever recall staying in hotels or things like that. Mm-hmm. We don't remember. Every summer, my dad would pack a station wagon, and be seven of us in there, and we'd have the top of the car all packed up and ready to go. And and I remember back then that in those days, you can go to Yosemite, and basically it was like free camping. You can set up a tent anywhere you wanted to. And nowadays, it's very restricted.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's just negatives and positives about that, but, you know, just there are a lot more restrictions these days.
Right.
Yeah, so.
So you were saying you sort of always knew that you wanted to go into law enforcement. Did you have maybe a mentor or somebody in your life that did that, or it was just something that you admired?
I think growing up, I saw a lot of my peers getting into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if anything influenced me was probably my coaches, you know. They were probably my mentors, you know, kind of keeping you on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, maybe that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, 32 years later, I'm still in law enforcement.
Yeah. And I'm sure you got an understanding of structure in the Air Force, too.
Oh, I did.
So,
you know, and
I'm sure that helped.
And that was a good experience for me, too. And like I say, it was a maturing experience for me, which I think prepared me to, you know, I was married, we had our first child, and I think it made me more responsible, I guess. And
mm-hmm.
then I knew that I needed to go to school to better myself and my family.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, I was discharged in 74, went back home, and spent 2 years at Ventura Junior College.
Mm-hmm.
And applied for admittance here to Sacramento State in 76, and I was accepted through the EEO program.
Hmm.
You know, so I was fortunate enough to get admitted here, and also fortunate enough to finish my degree in 4 years. So I wasn't on that 5 or 6 year plan.
Most of us are.
Yeah. So, and also, I mean, as a result of my military experience, I was able to, you know, GI Bill, I had that, and I was also enrolled in a law enforcement assistance program here at Sac State, and got tuition and books paid for, and basically as long as you stayed in a career field that dealt with law enforcement, you didn't have to pay it back, so I never had to pay that grant back, and like I said, 32 years later, I'm still in law enforcement.
Yeah. So, what made you decide to come to Sacramento? Was it the program here, or was it just the area, or?
Well, a combination of both. I think we were stationed at Travis in Fairfield, and we had relatives. My wife had some relatives here in Sacramento, mm-hmm. so we would come up and visit on the weekends, and we enjoyed the area. So we figured, it was more expensive to come to your 4-year school, do 4 years. So we figured, let's go back home with family, and we have a support group there, and they can help us out with babysitting and things like that. So we were fortunate enough, like I said, I did my 2 years lower division courses at Ventura Junior College, mm-hmm. and then came up here to Sac State. I actually applied to San Diego and Berkeley at the same time, but Sac State came through first, and I figured, well, let's go here. Mm-hmm. And I finished up my degree work in 2 years, my upper division courses. So also worked in the packing houses at night, and volunteered at Youth Authority here in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And because I was enrolled in school social work with an emphasis on corrections, we had to do our student project my senior year. So even though I was working at Youth Authority, which basically helped me out because they placed me at the Youth Authority parole office, mm-hmm. for my student program, it was kind of ironic because a lot of the juvenile wards that I had on my caseload at Youth Authority, I also saw them on the parole status at Sacramento, mm-hmm. parole for wards and Youth Authority. So I think by that time I knew, law enforcement is my career. So I did, like I said, volunteered at Youth Authority and starting in 77, I believe. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated in 78, I already had a job. So, I think I was further ahead than most students because I was able to have a good paying job before I graduated, bought our first house before I graduated. Nice. So it was good. Spent my first two and a half years in state service with Youth Authority. And then in 1980, Department of Fish and Game was basically recruiting. Mm-hmm. And apparently, Department of Fish and Game, being a resource agency, enforcement division, had a tough time recruiting minorities into the enforcement ranks of the department. So I think in order to keep from being sanctioned by State Personnel Board, department went out and actively recruited minorities in law enforcement and with a degree. Mm-hmm. And basically, that's what I had. Even though I had a good paying job with the Youth Authority, I figured, this might be a different something that might fit me. I enjoyed the outdoors, grew up in the outdoors, experienced the outdoors. And so I went downtown and just introduced myself, and not knowing their structure, their military type structure, mm-hmm. I actually ended up speaking with the chief of patrol back then, Ned Dalahite. And
Dalahite,
yeah. I didn't realize that he was the chief of patrol. And, mm-hmm. basically, was kind of my first interview, not knowing it, mm-hmm. And I was invited back to a chief's interview, and I was successful, and transferred over to Fish and Game in 1980. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I told my wife that I was going to take a position as a game warden with Fish and Game, and she'll never forget this. I went to the department, Fish Game headquarters on 9th Street, and they gave me this box because I was assigned to go to the police academy in Southern California beginning in the latter part of January. So I went to the department, and they gave me this box of equipment, and in that equipment, it included my sand brown belt, my leather gear, my gun, ammunition, and all these other cop things, and I come home, and the wife goes, and she sees the stuff in the box, and she goes, "What's this?" "I didn't know you were going to do this." I go, "Well, what did you think a game warden did? It's a peace officer position."
Right.
And I don't think she was ready for that, but we got through that, and I began my police academy training down in Orange County, Golden West College.
So did just really quick, what was your bachelor's degree in?
Bachelor's degree in from School of Social Work with an emphasis on corrections.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So then when you were hired on with the Fish and Game, they sent you to police training.
Right.
So that was your boot camp?
Well, I guess you could call it boot camp, but every game warden in California is a peace officer, just like any other police officer in the state. We have the same powers as a police officer. In a way, a little bit more of police powers, because we also have federal authority. We're federally deputized by Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay.
So we're able to... And then our enforcement authority goes throughout the state of California. We're not restricted to the city boundaries or county boundaries or things like that, because Fish and Game Law basically covers all of California, all the wildlife resources in California.
So it sort of overrides that for in terms
I guess
of
you can say
fishing,
what,
wildlife, and
yeah,
nature?
You can say, and I know that as far as Fish and Game Law is concerned, our inspection authority to inspect anything that we feel might carry any wildlife, if we have a probable cause to believe that this person was involved in any activity that involved the taking of wildlife, then we have this authority to go and inspect their vehicles or their person or anything that might carry wildlife without a search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Police officers have to have probable cause, first of all, to make a stop. And then if they want to look in their trunk or something like that, they have to have permission. If they don't get permission, they can't look in the trunk.
Right.
With Fish and Game officers, we have the authority to inspect, and that authority has been challenged up to the state Supreme Court several times. And several times we've always come out on top to allow Fish and Game officers anywhere in the state to inspect anywhere in the state for fish and wildlife, because it is so sensitive and it's a very transitory type of a resource.
Mm-hmm.
So people can take it anywhere and destroy it if we had to wait for search warrant.
Right.
So.
So let's go back to your police training. What was that like? What did you have to do? What did that entail?
You know, actually, for me, it was I actually enjoyed it. It was a lot more for me. It was a lot more structured than the Air Force Academy. It's funny because at my academy there was five other fish and game officers there, so there was a total of six of us going to the police academy. And every one of the game wardens in that class was a veteran, military veteran. So we were more mature. I looked at it as we were more mature than the other officers in the class, because a regular police officer, all they need is a GED or a high school graduate and 20, 21 years of age to go to police academy. But they really haven't had any life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that life experience is a must and a plus for anyone getting into the law enforcement field, whether it be Fish and Game or any city, county, or state law enforcement agency.
Mm-hmm.
It, for me, I enjoyed it. It was a challenge academically, but I think that overall, I think that the wardens in the academy were a lot more mature, and I think the instructors saw that in us. So we were always at the top of the class. And
so you had to go through classes?
Regular police training.
Okay.
And in addition to that, after we graduated, I think we were there for about 20 weeks. So, you know, it was an extensive...
Yeah.
Back in 1980, in those days, the academies were about 20 weeks long.
Mm-hmm.
So it was extensive training. And I can remember day one, kind of a foggy, gloomy day. And to this day, I talk to other wardens that I graduated with. Remember day one at the academy, where through the fog comes these drill instructors with their dark glasses, and you can hear their shoes tapping on the concrete. Kind of, oh boy, what are we in for? What did we get into? You know, it's kind of military training all over again.
Yeah.
But
so then, do they teach you, what exactly did you learn? Did you learn about wildlife if you didn't already know it, or?
Back then, when a fish and game warden was hired, they all got sent to police training, okay? Basically, you learn how to be a police officer, you know, how to make car stops, how to, you know, the legal, learning probable cause, things like that, defensive tactics, firearms training, legal updates. And basically, when we finished the academy, we were trained to be a police officer. Nothing in the academy, we weren't given anything in the academy that dealt with fish and game.
Okay.
there were times when we would have a fish and game supervisor come to the academy to talk about fish and game law and things like that, but that had nothing to do with the police academy.
Okay.
You know, I went to school with our academy consisted of police officers from Compton PD, Anaheim Police Department, Huntington Beach, basically all the coastal towns along Southern California, and university police were there also. Mm-hmm. So basically, and then majority of our TAC staff, our training staff, was LAPD staff, so which I think was, as far as Stress Academy, that academy was probably one of the most stressful in the state, because basically they figured if you could pass the stress in the academy, then maybe this was not the right job for you.
Right.
Because you're going to get stressed out on the street.
Right.
So you're going to come across situations where you're going to have to think on your feet, and they are stressful at times, and if you can't do that, then maybe you need to move on.
Yeah, that's where the life experience comes
exactly.
In.
And then after the police academy, then Fish and Game provided us with maybe a week orientation of fish and game training. And it was basically an overview of what we do. We got to go on a ride along with a fish and game officer and things like that. But, and I can remember when I graduated, then I went, my first assignment was the Point Doom position in Southern California.
Point Doom?
Point Doom, D-U-M-E, which is basically Malibu area.
Oh, okay.
It was headquartered out of Point Doom, and my area responsibility, I was assigned to Marine Patrol, which was coastal Marine Enforcement. Basically, I was assigned to patrol the coast for ocean activity, sport, and commercial. Mm. So it was kind of ironic because we were in Sacramento when I took the fish and game position, and my first position was back to Oxnard. So we were back home again.
So then you moved.
So we moved again from Sacramento after buying our house here, and then sold it, moved back to Oxnard, and we were back with family again.
Awesome.
And I think they chose me for that position because I was familiar with the area. I think with most fish and game officers, half the battle is knowing your district. And I think I had an advantage over most officers because I grew up there and I knew where all the activity was, because, you know, I would ditch school just to go fishing at the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time going fishing with my neighbor across the street, and we were fishing underneath the docks there at the port, and he got a hook stuck in his toe.
Oh.
And I go, oh boy, how are we gonna, you know, we first of all, we're ditching school to go fishing.
Right.
And now we got a hook in this guy's toe. And
the
how
evidence.
How do we do this? You know, we got in trouble.
Yeah.
We got caught.
Yeah.
So.
And plus, you know, going back home, that's a good point. You're already familiar with culture, too.
Exactly.
Every area has a different culture and ways of doing things. So.
Exactly. And then I think also the fact that I'm bilingual, mm-hmm. fluent in Spanish. You know, California is such a diverse state, a lot of different cultures here. And so I think the fact that I spoke Spanish really helped me out, because I would say on a daily basis, probably more than 50% of my contacts were Spanish-speaking resource users. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the ocean, at least among the Hispanic community, they grew up a lot, you know, they grew up in the ocean, around the ocean, so they used the resources from the ocean quite a bit, but they weren't always aware of our fish and game laws in California.
Right.
Basically, it's there for them to take, and that wasn't the case, you know. So I would have to educate them.
Mm-hmm. So what did that look like when you had to approach somebody and tell them that they were
it's just like any other law enforcement position, you know, you know, there are times when you come across people, you know, regardless of what you're doing, that maybe they don't know the laws. And, you know, you can tell, you can read a person.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, then you educate them. You're going to educate them, show them what they're doing wrong. You can give them a warning or whatever. Or you have the authority to issue a citation if you want. But it's, you know, a lot of times just giving them a warning and talking to them is a lot better than giving them a sour taste in their mouth for any peace officer.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's times when you had to be stern and issue a citation just because, you know.
The warning wasn't enough.
The warning wasn't enough. And then times you did give warnings and you caught them doing it again, then, you know, just hammer them. Give them a ticket. Mm-hmm. Make them learn.
Did you ever have times where somebody was resistant or not cooperative and you had to be a little bit...
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of times where basically you gave the... whoever your contact was, you gave them a choice. Look, this is what you need to do. If you don't, then we're going to do it my way. And my way is you're going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
It's your call.
Mm-hmm.
And I always said that, okay, I'll do it. I'll do whatever you want me to, but you have your choices. And knowing those choices, what do you want to do? Yeah. Do you want to go to jail or do you want to cooperate?
Mm-hmm.
It's easy, you know. So most of the time, they cooperated.
Yeah. Nobody wants to go to jail.
Yeah. So,
you know, being Hispanic, do you think, and then having the Fish and Game really looking for minorities to bring into the culture of a warden, do you think, obviously that helped you, but do you think that you not only benefited, but did you get the opposite side of that? Did you get either racial discrimination, or were there times where you just, I don't know, maybe didn't feel comfortable, or you got some other sides to that?
Well, I don't think it was the fact that I didn't feel comfortable. I think when I came on to Fish and Game, I was, I think, the only second Hispanic in the department. Mm-hmm. So I knew of one lieutenant that was in the department, and then I came on and I was only the second Hispanic in the department, the history. You're talking 1980 now,
yeah.
You know, and then we're beyond the civil rights, you know, and yet we have agencies that are still struggling to make up a force that's representative of the culture of California, the diversity. And I remember going to meetings and comments being made regarding my ethnicity, and then comments, kind of stereotype comments and things like that. And I just basically kept it to myself. And I was lucky enough that I worked with some very good supervisors that were aware of that, and they were around and they heard these comments, so they would take those people that are officers that would make comments like that, and they took care of it. And I understood that and I appreciated that. But by the same token, I didn't want any preference because of who I was.
Right.
And I remember, and up to this date, throughout my law enforcement career, I still remember going to meetings and throughout my career where I was the only minority in the room. So, and I know that as I went on with my patrol duties, that people looked at me a little bit different. You know, oh, wow, there's a Mexican Fish and Game warden. That's that's rare.
Yeah.
So I think in a way, I saw myself as a trailblazer, and I needed to be that much better. And I think the fact that I was able to promote to assistant chief, for me at least, showed me that, well, maybe I'm doing this right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know that Fish and Game, even when I came on, that I would be used to do recruitment seminars. I remember one time going CHP, allowing me to go to one of their training sessions, and then their daily briefings to recruit for Fish and Game wardens. And again, I mean, wherever I would go, it's mostly, you know, white officers and things like that. But I was more focused to finding minority officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also at the time I came out, we had one female Fish and Game officer, and then no blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to this day, I can't think of any black officers in Fish and Game Department right now. And they're making strides with females. We have a lot more females now, and a lot more Hispanic officers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's always going to be a challenge for any department in the resources agencies, whether it be state park rangers, fish and game officers, anyone that does any type of resource work to recruit minority officers, because basically, minorities are more used to seeing police officers.
Mm-hmm.
They're not used to seeing game wardens or park rangers unless you've experienced that. So for that reason, I think the Resources Agency needs to do a better job in recruitment. And, you know, also, you know, with recruitment comes dollars, and, you know, that's money that comes out of your budget for recruitment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's good and bad things about it. But I think overall, if the public sees a well-rounded group of officers throughout the state, I think it's a lot better for the department.
Mm-hmm. And it maybe even sets a different standard of, you know, what the wardens are
exactly
enforcing.
Yeah, because I know that, I remember when I used to go into deer camps and things like that, and I would go into deer camp with minority, you know, Hispanic hunters, and it would be like, you know, wow, you know, I'm glad to see you that you're out here doing it, and they, a lot of support for that.
Yeah, so you did get support from...
Oh, yeah, there was support from the hunters out there in the public,
yeah.
And then...
just for that fact alone.
Exactly, awesome. And I remember going, year after year, going into deer camps, and the same people that hunted, that, I mean, you'd see a lot more minority hunters rather than, you know, the minority fish and game officers. Mm-hmm. But, and I think it kind of put them at ease, too, seeing one of their own out there doing the work. Mm-hmm. And... I got satisfaction out of that.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So then when you got back to Oxnard, I'm backtracking a little bit. Mm-hmm. When you got back to Oxnard, what was your position there?
As when I went back to Oxnard and I started my first fishing game assignment at Point Doom. Back then it was Marine Patrol Resources, so I was a fishing game warden. And I was also assigned as a part-time boarding officer to our patrol boat, Yellowtail, which was stationed out of Channel Islands Harbor. Mm-hmm. And then we would go out and boat patrol, a lot of overnight patrols, and we would get the squad together and patrol around the Channel Islands and things like that. So, I mean, there was a lot of times in this job where it's not, by no means is it an 8-to-5 job, because you were the only officer assigned to your district. Mm-hmm. I mean, my district would run from Santa Barbara County through Ventura County and L.A. County.
Oh, wow.
That was my district, one warden.
Wow.
One officer.
So you had to take care of any calls that happened?
Yeah. And with Fish and Game, your headquarters was your home. So I remember back in those days, that, you know, recording machines or machines that answered your phone were barely coming out. This was before the computer age, too.
Right.
You know, so, and before cell phones.
Yeah.
And I remember if I was out on patrol, then if my wife needed to get a hold of me, she'd have to call her dispatch center, and then they would have to relay the message. Uh-huh. And then by the same token, you know, when I say that a fish and game warden's office is his home, so basically, I had a bedroom set aside as my fish and game office. So basically, you've got a state office. They supplied you with a state phone. Well, no computers back then,
right.
But office supplies and things like that. So when that phone rang, and then the office supplied us with an answering machine, before the answering machine, the wife would answer the phone, and she would have to take calls and messages and relay them to me. And so she was kind of my home dispatcher, you know,
right.
Doing state work. Without getting paid.
Right.
So, and I think it's the same with all the officers throughout California. You know, the fish and game is not only the game warden out there, it's the family too. So there's truly a fish and game family, because it goes to your spouse and your kids and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They see the work you do on a daily basis. I mean, you don't get up and report to an office for roll call. When you get up, you know, you might get up to answer the phone. There's something going on. And
right.
By that, you know, local law enforcement agencies also have your phone number. If they get a call from their dispatch center, they call you at your house on the
mm-hmm.
state line.
Oh,
and
okay.
24/7, you know. Yeah. And if there's an emergency, you got to go.
It's you.
Yeah. And you have your district. You know what's going on. You're expected to respond to all the calls day or night. There's no shift work. You're not there from 8 to 5, you know. So
you're always on
you're
duty.
You're kind of always on duty, but you know, you're on call when you haven't, you know, you might have worked your 8 hours, so the rest of the day, you know, you go home and answer phone calls and things like that. So, but you allow yourself during that 8 hour period to go home, answer phone calls, do reports and things like that. So, I mean, a warden's job is unique because, you know, you also have a truck or vehicle that you took home every day. You know, for 30 years, I never had to drive to work.
Mm-hmm.
My truck or car was always at home.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, that's a good point. How did your family respond to this life?
Well, I mean, the wife had to get used to it. First of all, she had to get used to the fact that I was a peace officer carrying a gun out in the public.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had to get used to the fishy game way of life because she not only had to put up with, you know, where's he at tonight or what's he doing right now? And, you know, it's what's happening. I know that she was worried about that. And
mm-hmm.
all wives, I think, do. And but they try not to show it. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to be aware of that. You know, what is she feeling? You know, I mean, there's a lot of times that I was always late for dinner, or never showed up for dinner, you know, or there would be times when the wife, I need you home because we're going over to such a, you know, a family affair and things like mm-hmm. that, and hey, babe, I'm, you know, I can't make it.
Yeah.
I'm doing work right now, and I'm going to be late, so there'd be a lot of times where I'd eat dinner at midnight, you know,
yeah.
It would be there on the table, and that's just the way it was. It's not an 8-to-5 job, not like a police officer where he finishes his shift and goes home and somebody comes in behind him and takes over.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop Game was not like that.
Yeah.
It's a unique experience, but by the same token, I think we had a lot of flexibility throughout our day, throughout our careers, because as my son was growing up, we had a daughter and a son, and I was able to take time off during the day and be with him with sports. I would coach soccer and baseball, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to attend, you know, school functions. And not knowing that, okay, now I've done this, now I've got to go back to work and finish out my 8 hours. So I can split my day up.
What?
Where a police officer can't really do that.
Right.
You know, you can't, hey, I got to go home and do this. You can't do it. But,
so what did the kids think about their dad being a warden?
Well, I think, growing up, it's just, okay, this is what Dad does,
mm-hmm.
you know. And one of the things that they knew that I was a peace officer and I carried a gun and things like that. So they were never really curious about my sidearm, my duty weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure that curiosity was gone, you know. I would show it to them. So I never had any problems if I had to come home during the day to do something, putting my gear on the table, because I knew they wouldn't bother it. And they never bothered it to this mm-hmm. day. So they've always been around firearms, and they respect it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it's that way with all peace officers throughout the state, regardless of who you work for.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I remember when I came on after the police academy that I was getting my first vehicle assigned to, and I went home and met with my captain, and okay, here's your new car. So I had a new car, patrol, wow, that's neat. But there wasn't any emergency equipment on there, no lights, sirens, or radio, or anything like that. So luckily enough, like I said, I knew the area, and I knew a lot of people that worked for the city of Oxnard. So I took my patrol vehicle to the city garage where they fix all the police cars, and I was able to, hey, can you guys put the equipment on for me? Yeah, they did it.
Okay.
They put my radios in, my sirens, everything. I was ready to go.
Nice.
You know, so, and I made sure I took care of them throughout my career. So, but and you had to be, I think, with a fishing game officer, you have to be resourceful. I think mm-hmm. if you're the type of person that you needed to get up and have someone tell you what to do today, this job's not for you. A few times throughout my career that we would get officers that needed a lot of direction. And like I said, if you need a lot of direction, you have to figure out what you need to do. Maybe this job's not for you. Maybe you want to go be a police officer, which is more structured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from here to here, this is where you're going to work.
Right.
You know, this is your area, you patrol it. With fish and game officers, these are the counties you work in. Go see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's going on. If you need help with some enforcement, then you would call your adjoining game warden, and then you would come up with a plan and meet someplace and take care of whatever's going on. So, you know, it was a very rewarding job for me, and I enjoyed it. I remember being on boat patrol up to the Channel Islands, and a lot of times that I'd be out there and just looking around and thinking, you know what, they're paying me to do this job, and people take time off and spend money to do this for vacation, you know. But by the same token, I mean, those were the good days, and then there were days out there where, you know what, they don't pay me enough to do this. A lot of days that we probably had no business being out there because of weather conditions and things like that, but a lot of times, because of what you do and the resource enforcement issues and things like that, you had to be out there. So, and your life was on the line, but you know what, I went home every night.
And that's true. I mean, there's many dangerous factors. Not only, you know, I hadn't thought about the weather, but yeah, you know, just because it's raining doesn't mean you stop.
Right? I remember times where we left our patrol boat, a crew would drop it off up in Morro Bay, and then we would drive up I remember one day I left the house, and me and another officer were going up to Morro Bay. I told the wife, okay, I'll be home late tonight because we're running the boat down from Morro Bay to Channel Islands. Well, we get to Morro Bay, and it's nice and clear. The weather's clear. The water's like glass. Oh, we're going to have a good ride back home. And so we grab a quick dinner, and we head out maybe about five or six miles off the coast, and so we can give ourselves a buffer in case something happens, you know. So we're riding south, and all of a sudden the weather turns bad. Mm-hmm. Just we're underwater most of the time. We button down the hatches, and we operate the boat from downstairs. And it's a 43-foot vessel, you know, and it's, you know, pretty good size. Mm-hmm. And we're underwater most of the time. We just crash into the waves, and our radar's not working that good because we're inside the troughs and the waves, and our radar's not, you know, we're in the water. You know, it's picking up just the waves around us. Mm-hmm. So we decide, you know, just a little bit after midnight, you know, we're not going to make it home. And so we barely make it into Avila Bay, which is, you know, from Morro Bay to Avila Bay is like a 20-minute drive. Well, that was like a six-hour run for us.
Oh, my gosh.
We barely made it in. And, you know, we got inside the harbor and dropped the anchor and went to bed. You know, just it was probably one of the most scary experiences for me and the other officers. I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Next morning we woke up and the weather was clear and we made it back. So what we thought would be maybe a one-day trip turned out to be 2.5 days.
Oh my God!
And those are things you go through.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time where we worked. We had some shrimp trawlers. These are big vessels that drag for the ocean bottom for shrimp. They were down from Washington, and they had come down to our waters in California to drag for shrimp, and you don't really see that off our coast, and these boats were out here because they thought, well, you know, California, since nobody does it, there's got to be areas where we can trawl for shrimp, you know, basically drag the nets on the ocean floor and pull it up and have all the shrimp. You mainly see it on the Gulf Coast, Louisiana, things like that. But I remember one day the two vessels had been here for maybe a couple of months and off of Ventura, and we had information, okay, these guys are fueling up and stocking up, they're going to leave the harbor. Well, what was going to happen is they were going to drag for shrimp on the way home back to Washington when the season was closed.
Oh, okay.
And they were going to figure by the time they drug for shrimp, brought their nets back in and put all the shrimp in their holding holes, by the time they made it to Washington, the season would be open. And they could basically set the market price. And we went out, and again, rough weather, really rough weather. And it was like, you know, you see these movies on TV where, you know, boats are crashing through the waves and things like that. And finally, you know, we were about ready to give up, and we were up above Point Conception. And on our radar, we picked up two blips, and okay, these last two blips might be them. So as we got closer and we got a visual contact, it was the two shrimp trawlers that were actually dragging the nets in the water when at the time that we made contact. I mean, weather was really rough, and one of our first officers, we had to board the boats. So we would come alongside, and the boats were going up and down next to each other with the waves. And I remember the first officer started to jump to the other boat, and he, for whatever reason, he stopped, and he hung on to a rail on the bow, and we had to grab him and pull him back over.
Oh my gosh.
And luckily enough, our officer who was operating our boat backed us up. Otherwise, it would have been tragic. So, but then after that, we got her back on. I decided, okay, I'll go for this one, and I was able to jump across and
get jumped on board, across into jumped the
across
other boat.
Into the other boat, and I remember landing on my butt and then getting up, and I'm right in, you know, knee deep in shrimp, and these guys knew they were caught. I mean, the season's closed, the nets in the water, and there's shrimp everywhere.
And you're standing in
the
boat.
I'm standing there, and I go, what's going on, guys? And the skipper goes, well, I guess we're kind of early, aren't we? I go, yeah, we are. So eventually the other officer got on board the other vessel, and we we seized the vessel, we brought the nets in, and we headed back to Ventura Harbor. Mm-hmm. And going back to Ventura Harbor from Point Conception, above north of Point Conception, at maybe 5 or 6 knots, I mean, that was another maybe a 10-hour ride.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and I remember on the way back, one of the vessel I was on, it was a wooden hull boat, and the ladder that went down into the engine room caught fire, because it was right next to the manifold, and the ladder caught fire.
Oh,
and I said, oh man, what am I, you know, this is not good, you know. We're going to, you know, we had visual contact with our patrol boat, but they were way ahead of us because they had to go back. We seized the boat, and, you know, we got the fire out. We seized them, went to Ventura Harbor, or Channel Islands Harbor, and took the shrimp off the boat, seized their nets and everything, and took a couple of guys to jail because they had outstanding warrants. But that ended up being, I think I worked for over 24 hours straight that day, you know, 2 days.
Right.
So we were, you know, without rest. And that's days that we, you know, those were just typical days.
Yeah.
You know.
So what happens to the shrimp after that?
Well, with fishing game law, what happens, anytime that you have a large amount of resource, you take whatever resource you're dealing with, you sell it at whatever the market price is.
Oh, okay.
The money is put into like I guess you could say it's in limbo, but the courts have it. So, and then we go to court, and then, okay, we present our case. A fisherman presents his excuses, and, mm-hmm. you know, why, you know. And I every case that we ever dealt with, we ended up winning anyway, and so the money would go back to fishing game. If for whatever reason the fisherman won, the commercial fisherman, convinced the jury that they weren't in the wrong, that,
mm-hmm.
then that money that we got from the sale of the whatever the resource was would go to the fisherman.
Oh, okay.
So he wouldn't lose anything. You know, the resource mm-hmm. is not going to spoil.
Right, that's what I was wondering. Okay. And you were saying, you know, sometimes you would get information. You had people that sort of helped you.
Oh, yeah.
Saying,
yeah.
I mean, I saw this, or...
Throughout the state, and that's with any law enforcement job, you know, you develop your sources, people that you can trust, and things like that. And then you'll get information. I mean, you can't do it yourself,
right.
You know. Whether it's other fellow peace officers, or... And that's why, you know, when with a fishing game officer, you always make sure that you... If you have an area where you know, a rural area, you know, get to know the ranch hands. Get, you know, if you got farmers or whatever, you know, stop by and say hi. You know, here's my phone number. If you got any problems, call me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. Day or night. You know, you'd be surprised how many times a rancher would call me at night that, hey, I got these guys poaching here at night, so here I go.
Mm-hmm.
So,
hmm.
But, yeah, like I say, a fish and game warden's career or daily life is not like your 8-to-5 police officer job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can truly say that I enjoyed my career with fish and game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that after I left, I was in, we were in my first position, Point Doom, through 85, and then we transferred up to Sacramento.
Okay.
And I was assigned to the Region 2 office here in Rancho Cordova. I worked there as a game warden for about, I think, a couple of years, two or three years. And then I took, I was assigned my special operations unit, our covert operations undercover team. Excuse me. I spent a year working with them, basically enforcing illegal commercialization of the state's resources. Mm-hmm. So I would, we would go out. Excuse me.
Do you want to stop?
Yeah.